So it's nice to see you all. And Tweri is assisting a retreat, so she asked me to come tonight and just offer a few reflections on the theme that you're already working with, which is the factors of awakening. So the seven aspects of mind that interact, that support one another, and lead in the direction of the sure heart's release or the freedom of the mind. And as I was reflecting on this topic, actually, what came to mind was a short story by the writer Raymond Carver, who may have never shown up in a Dharma talk before, led a very challenged life. But there's a short story of his that's entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And it's the story of four friends sitting around at a dinner party and trying to get at the heart of what love is. And so as they talk about it, at the beginning, they all have very clear ideas of what they think love is. And as they talk, they each speak from their own experience. And the night goes on. And mostly they're talking about what distorts love. So they set out trying to figure out what love is, and they end up discussing distortions of love. And then by the end, it goes quiet, conversation dies out, and they're left just four humans sitting in a room, breathing together. So it reminds me a little bit of kind of our task or what we do when we set out to talk about what mindfulness is these days, right? So many different definitions, understandings, approaches to it, but it's really a beautiful conversation to be having, right? Especially among friends, speaking honestly, directly from our own experiences. So the difference in the short story, those of you who have read it, the members of the dinner party were not steeped in ethical sensitivity. There was a lot of gin involved. So tonight, virtue is a big support. Ethical sensitivity is a big support for the arising of mindfulness. But tonight, we'll hopefully start a conversation or continue a conversation about kind of how mindfulness functions, what it is, what supports it. Its kind of depth and breadth, and maybe how it refers back to silence. So we'll do that minus the gin. When I, with the under 40 group that I've led, we just finished a few months ago with the Noble Eightfold Path. So as I was researching and thinking about wise mindfulness for that series, I did a little experiment with Google in which it seems these days that there's mindful everything, right? Mindful walking, mindful eating, mindful gardening, mindful anything. So I did this little experiment where anything that came to my mind for a Google search, I would just pair it. So whatever I could think of, or just see, does this exist? Mindful kite surfing, mindful basket weaving, mindful pottery, mindful anything. And the answer is, it does. Whatever you can think of paired with mindfulness, someone's thought of it and they're doing it and they're probably charging for it. So it's become this thing, right? This word that gets paired with almost anything we do. And I think it's kind of in danger of becoming just like an enhancer, right? A little enhancer, like a boost, like adding a plus or an exclamation point to whatever we're doing. So it's a little bit in danger of losing its nuance and some of its depth. Because the reality is that mindfulness can enhance whatever it is we're doing, but especially as a factor of awakening, the intention or the aim isn't just to become, you know, a more effective, efficient employee, mindful data entry or a mindful presentation, but the deeper aim or intention is to use whatever circumstances we find ourselves in to transform the mind and heart. Not just becoming about becoming more effective, although it can do that too. But what really deeply transforms the mind and heart? This was the Buddha's primary concern, primary aim, and especially with the factors of awakening, it's just right in there in this list, stated explicitly. So mindfulness as one element of a full path rather than the end point. And this is what the Buddha, start a little bit with some of the Buddha's words about being mindful. It says, "Stay mindful, practitioners, and alert. This is our instruction to you all. And how is a practitioner mindful? There's the case where a practitioner remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. She remains focused on feelings, focused on mind, focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. This is how a practitioner is mindful." So there are all these other qualities that kind of come in and support mindfulness. So this quality of ardency, which I like to think of as kind of devotion, commitment, the willingness to endure, sometimes it's talked about, and full alertness, so full presence. And then putting aside greed and distress for the world. This is the crucial part, right? This is kind of where it leads. And so I know prior to the factors of awakening, you were working with the hindrances. And these two lists are, in putting them side by side, you're always strengthening one and weakening the other. So in the text it's talked about, you starve one and feed the other. So as you're working with wanting, not wanting, worry, restlessness, doubt, the factors of awakening, which are mindfulness, investigation, effort, energy, joy, tranquility, these are being weakened. And as you're strengthening mindfulness, investigation, energy, the hindrances are being weakened. So sometimes they're talked about, these seven factors, as anti-hindrances. Right? So often think about this as like the antifreeze in the car, right? The hindrances, it seems as though their job is to kind of congeal us into kind of repetitive patterns that help us stay solid. These factors of awakening are deliberately intended to kind of help unbind us, right? So like the antifreeze. So it's helpful to think of these as relating to each other, the hindrances and the awakening factors. Oftentimes it seems like our whole practice, especially in the beginning, is just a guided tour through the hindrances. And that's the only thing that's going on. But as we look deeper and we stay with, we can sense that there's also this other current that's operating. So Ajahn Suchito talks about the seven factors as almost like a thermal of awakening that a bird would catch, right? So it takes a bit of doing. So the first three factors are mindfulness, investigation, and effort or energy. And those require a little bit from us to kind of get the momentum going. But after that, it's like we've caught a current in which the rest can unfold relatively naturally. This is a causal sequence. So I realized I haven't stated the whole list yet, but many of you probably know it. So mindfulness allows us to just bear something in mind, keep a frame around experience, which I'll mention, go into a little bit more. And then as we look closer to it, investigate its characteristics, look into its nature, what happens is the mind brightens a little bit, right? And some energy is freed up. And then as we stay with and persist and continue and adjust our energy so it's not too tight and not too loose, then lo and behold, there's some happiness, joy, piti. It doesn't need to be a flood of rapture, but some energy gets freed up that was previously going around in a circle tied in on itself. So now there's a bit of brightness and energy in the mind. Oops. And if we can stay a little steady in that, not get too excited about our own brightness, there's a calm or a tranquility. It settles down a little bit. This allows the mind to gather together, to be collected, to be somewhat unified, and allows us to see things more clearly as they are, rather than with the backdrop of our own wanting or agitation. And then we find a wise balance or a wise peace of equanimity, right? So I think this list is beautiful in the way that in the beginning, like with any endeavor, we're sort of involved. Like there is some doing in those first three steps, mindfulness, investigation, and effort. And then it's like we've got some momentum and we've got a feel for it. We've caught the thermal, or we're riding the bike to some degree, right? We've got some of our own momentum. So this also strengthens faith. We can have confidence in this flow of experience. And I used to think about this as, you know, instead of being MIA, missing in action, absent, spaced out, caught up, it can be M-I-E, mindful investigating and applying some degree of effort or energy, right? You can watch how those three are in interplay. And this is a stream that frees us up. So not mindfulness on its own, kind of transplanted from its context, but how these factors relate to one another, support, enhance, and successively lead one to the next. So there's a real beauty in this, a real beauty. And once we get a feel for it, there can be a much greater appreciation and understanding for what we're responsible for in practice and what we aren't. So in the beginning and at various points along the way, it can feel very much like this is me here doing my mindfulness practice, pumping it out, doing it, right? Some of that energy can be helpful in the beginning to help get us in the door, onto the cushion, But then it takes some different qualities to help move us along in a path that deepens, that develops. So I'll just speak about no? Hello? Yes, okay, I get a thumbs up, thank you. So I'll just speak about mindfulness in a couple different ways and also use the Buddha loved analogies, right? So he loved lists. The lists were kind of composed afterwards as a memory enhancing device, but he often used similes and analogies. So I'll just offer a few of these. This may be a little bit different, maybe, than the way you've been thinking about it, but also these tend to plant images in the mind that get retained over time, that when we're in the flux of daily life, sometimes these come back and we can get a feel for, oh, okay, where's the thermal, you know? So I'll just offer a little bit around this. So the most kind of basic or fundamental definition of mindfulness classically is sati, which is to remember, right? The translation in Pali is sati, and it's the function of the mind that can remember or recall. So in my teacher training, someone came and gave a, keeps going in and out. Oh, that's okay. I think I can do it as long as I'm not fighting with the fan. You're okay? No, Jerry's not. Okay. Yeah. Don't touch it. Okay. Okay. Okay, so I'll just keep going and maybe it will decide to touch back in again. Okay. Yeah, also if you'd like to move closer, that might be a good alternate solution too. In my teacher training, someone came and gave a presentation on kind of applications of mindfulness, so bringing mindfulness into various settings. And she was mentioning, which I didn't know, that Jon Kabat-Zinn, when he came up with this idea of bringing mindfulness into hospitals as stress reduction, helping people with their physical and mental well-being. He came on retreat, he came up with a word. He wanted to come up with one word that would be easily translatable in many different contexts, but at the same time could encapsulate the whole of the Dharma. And so he chose mindfulness as a word that would be understandable enough to Westerners in a variety of settings, wouldn't be ostracizing, but his intention was to have the whole of the Dharma kind of fold into this one word. And so the definition often gets a little packed, gets a little bloated sometimes, right? So a present moment, non-judgmental, non-reactive, loving awareness. There are a lot of things tacked on there often, and they're all skillful, and they're all helpful, and they're often referring to bits of this seven factors of awakening. But at its core, at its like bare bones classical definition, sati means to remember, to recollect, to bear something in mind. When we talk about bearing something in mind, if you tell someone, bear this in mind, you're asking them to remember it. So this is interesting. So in a way, we're asked, invited to remember kind of the present moment's experience. We're asked to remember what it is we most deeply value and kind of refer back to that regularly. But we're also asked to remember or bear in mind the scope of the teachings, right? So it's integrated. daily life, practical pointers are integrated. So it has some breadth. Mindfulness has some breadth. And I was playing with this, again, preparing for the Under 40 series with Wise Mindfulness. Playing with this, how does mindfulness affect memory, our ability to recall? Analia, the Buddhist scholar, says our capacity to be present in this moment's experience, to be mindful in this present moment's experience, enables our ability to remember correctly. Right? It's interesting to think about it that way. So I was playing with this and bringing attention, bringing awareness to one of my most habitual times of day, which is leaving one client and moving on to the next, right? And I'm often in a hurry. So get in the car, leaving one intense situation, and the mind immediately plunges forward into the next situation. So I'm barely aware of getting into the car, what my hands, what my body's doing. And I was playing with this. It's like, what would I remember about this situation later? This situation that I've been in 1,000 times that would go by in a blur if I hadn't primed mindfulness, right? What would I remember? And so just by priming it, I was aware, my hands on the steering wheel, there were two bikers right in front of me. I was aware of my speed in relationship to other cars around me. I was taking in everything I could from the situation. And it became more full, became a fuller experience of that moment. And then I got pulled over. I hear the sirens and I got, you know, the lights and everything. So I pulled over to the side of the road and they say, do you know why I pulled you over? And I said, well, I was probably going a little bit above the speed limit because I had just primed mindfulness. I knew that. And she said, well, what happened there? And so because I had just primed it, I was able to recall moment by moment what had just happened, how I was in relationship to the bikers, how I had pulled around, sped up in order to give them a wide space, how I had slowed down, but probably not soon enough, just a play-by-play of what had happened. And about a few minutes in, she just looked at me and she said, okay, you can go. Just go ahead. Just go. Just go. And I just kind of sat there and marveled at that experience because it really does work. You know, not only does it add breadth to our present moment's experience that would go by in a blur, but it does enable a clear functioning of memory, right? So this is interesting. And it refers not to just this external, as you would on a witness stand, like just the external facts. So it's not that either, but it also has this depth to it. So that kind of talks about the breadth aspect, but mindfulness also has this depth to it. So not just what's happening externally, the sights, sounds out there, you know, what other people are doing in relationship, but also it's constantly referring back to this heart, mind, and how it's being affected moment by moment, right? So this interplay, this relationship, this exchange of external to internal. So one aspect of this, which I found really helpful in my own practice, is this aspect of attention that's called, it's referred to in a lot of different ways, wise attention, appropriate attention, fathoming attention, an attention that, you know, like within this fathom-long body, a fathom extends down into the depths of the ocean, that can feel out how the heart mind is affected by each moment of experience, So not just what's happening externally, but this affective process. So mindfulness can kind of, and these are always supporting each other. So if mindfulness kind of puts a frame of reference around the present moment, you know, body, feelings, mind objects, this fathoming attention. So in the Pali, it's yoniso manasikara. I'll explain a little bit more about that. But this fathoming attention supports each aspect, each factor of awakening, and allows it to continue. So if we're going to kind of continue or develop or be supported by each of these factors, we have to have a very clear sense of what's going on in the mind. We have to know the frame of mind and refer back to that over and over again. So Ajahn Suchito has a beautiful analogy for this. Says, mindfulness is the moment of holding the question, how am I with this? So it just holds that question, how am I with this, in its depth aspect. To use the image of a hand, attention is like the fingers, and citta, or the heart mind, is like the palm. Fingers can probe, twiddle, and touch, but are unable to collect anything. The palm can't probe and inquire, but it receives, collects, and fully feels what the fingers place in it. So citta has the storekeeper's wisdom. It wants to know what is worth being in touch with, what can be held for one's welfare. It certainly needs educating, and that is the function of deep or wise attention. The attention that refers sense data to the feeling and responsive heart-mind. This then is another support of mindfulness. Deep attention draws on skillful intention, or the inclination of the heart and mind. To assess that experience, to feel how a sight or sound, thought or memory affects you, deep attention clarifies the impression, the sense contact in the heart. So when right view and deep attention guide mindfulness, this results in a clear, ethically tuned awareness. Right? So this is kind of attending appropriately, right? Keeping our frame of reference in the present moment, but also referring it back, referring the input through the sense doors back to how we're being affected moment by moment. And it's there, from there, that we can sense what is helpful, what is unhelpful, what is skillful, what is unskillful, what needs to be fed, what could be ignored or kind of starved, what needs to be responded to. It's this very progressive kind of feedback loop. And maybe an easier way to get a sense of that is how it looks in the mind when we're attending inappropriately, right? Which is normally. When we're left to our own devices, what's normal attention? And what's usually talked about is inappropriate attention. And this is what that looks like. This is how one attends inappropriately. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what was I in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I be in the future? Or else one is inwardly perplexed about the immediate present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where is this being come from? And from all this, views arise. I have a self. I have no self. this very self of mine, this very no self of mine, from all of these views arise. So do you get a feel for this kind of Tanisaro Bhikkhu scholar monk talks about this as the wrong kind of questioning, right? What did I do? Was that right? Did I say that right? What was that about? What am I? Am I this? Am I that? What are they? Are they this? Are they that? You know, and the self forms, get solidified, becomes, it's this questioning. But the factors of awakening, mindfulness included, are not personal qualities that we either have or don't have. They're inherent capacities of the mind that can either be activated or dormant. Right? So it's not my mindfulness, it's not my tranquility, just like it's not my restlessness, it's not my worry. They're impersonal factors of the mind. So this kind of questioning, getting caught, can feel it as like a whirlpool or a spiral of thinking. It goes around in a circle, around and around and around. The rolling on of samsara, right? Just goes around and around and around. So that's inappropriate attention. Appropriate attention holds a frame. What's going on in this present moment's experience? How am I being affected? What's it like in the heart and mind right now? And that can be fully known and deepened. An analogy the Buddha uses for this is, it's like a skillful cook. And he gives the example of a cook who's trying to cook for a master or a king, and tries to get a sense every day. He'll make a new curry and tries to get a sense of what does the king actually like. You know? Tries to pick up on what is the king responding to? Try these ingredients, try those ingredients. What's the king actually responded to? So a person who is attending inappropriately, or a cook who's not attending wisely, would keep trying things but not notice the effect, not be able to pick up this theme of the master's mind or the one who's being served, not being able to really be sensitive to what the effect is. So we keep trying things, keep experimenting, but real learning isn't able to take place. And so it's just like this, in a way, that if we're sensitive and we're applying this kind of deep attention, we're sensitive to the theme as it's running through our own mind, right? The frame of our own mind. Sayadaw Tejaniya talks about this yoniso manasikara as right attitude, right? The kind of background attitude that we can be carrying or holding in the mind and referring back to over and over again. So just to offer another perspective, Tanisara and Kirisaro, two teachers in this tradition trained in the Thai forest tradition, talk about this quality of yoniso manasikara as placing the mind's activities in the womb of awareness. That's how they translate that. So yoni as womb, mana as mind, so placing this endless kind of activity of mind and referring it back to awareness, letting it be held in the space of awareness. Yoniso manasikara. So this is very different than a cursory mindfulness, right? This is a mindfulness that knows its depths, becomes more familiar with its origins, what it's arising out of. So it doesn't just know the contents of experience, but it knows kind of the nature of the experience and more the nature of that mind itself. So the teacher puts it this way. This is Ajahn Tiradamo, again in the Thai forest tradition. As mindfulness develops, it becomes what I interpret as a full awareness of mind. When we're aware of the body, we start off with a sense of I doing it. First of all, it's I'm being aware of my body. That's the first level. The next level is I'm being aware of the body. It's not so much mine anymore, just the body is physical conditions. Then comes I'm just being aware. And finally, just awareness with nobody being aware. If there's still a sense of I being aware, it's not full awareness of mind. There's still a bit of me in it. But once awareness is developed in the fullest sense, there's fully complete awareness of mind. The mind is fully aware without any need for a sense of self to know it, to be aware, to be present. And this full awareness of mind can penetrate through the ignorance of selfhood and reveal the truth of impersonality. That's the highest development of mindfulness. Oh, that's part of the sense of mindfulness as a path, something that deepens, develops, and it has this ability to penetrate, to be kind of very narrow and kind of discerning at a point. Also has the capacity to stand back and take in all aspects of a situation. Right? So sometimes in the text, this is talked about as a cow herder. Referred to the analogy of cow herding. So once the cows have been trained to some degree and there's no longer a danger of the cows eating the crops, the cow herder can relax the boundary a little bit, rest back, and instead of mindfulness being close up, maintaining a boundary, it can relax, it can open up, and there's still alertness, still wisdom, still clear knowing, but it's seeing the whole of the situation, how I'm being affected, what's going on externally, how elements are relating to each other, and it has this a more open sense. So depending on context, what's around it, what we're practicing with, it can have all of these different aspects, qualities, functions. So in my understanding, our definition of mindfulness should deepen over time. It should be changing. You know, it only starts to get worrisome when we really are clear that this is what we mean, right? This is what mindfulness is. It should be something that's kind of continually changing. Like we know our direction, we kind of know our capacities, we have confidence in the practice, but I think that the definition, our understanding should be changing over time. What is my experience of this? How am I relating to this over time? So, I was reading something by Norman Fisher, the Zen teacher, and he said, he was participating in an interfaith dialogue with a rabbi friend of his. This was many years ago. I think the rabbi has passed away. Alan Liu, I believe, something like that. And they were offering kind of highlights from Judaism and Buddhism. And the rabbi said something to Norman about the main problem with Buddhism, from what I can tell, is that it just makes too much sense. Right? It just makes too much sense. People are so attracted to it because they think they understand it and it's practical. And it has all of these lists that appeal to our analytical mind. And people can assume that they grasp it and get a hold of it. And it is immensely practical. I think that's also true. But we can also constantly check our assumption. What does it mean for me now? What's my direct experience of it like now? So checking our assumptions that we really understand what we mean. So this assumption, I think, prompted someone to write a book about why Buddhism is true. Somebody who had barely, this person, I think, and it's doing a lot of, it's generating a lot of interest and people are practicing. And so we can look at it on the surface and yes, this all seems very good and true. It all seems right. And as long as that's a kind of faith that then allows the investigation to look deeper, then it can have a forward kind of developing direction, but not as an end in itself. So wisdom, as it's operating, is not this, you know, it's like the factors of awakening kind of culminate with this expression of wisdom, a wisdom that is also peace, right? Equanimity. And this isn't a stoic indifference. This isn't an untouchable quality, but it can be a kind of unshakable peace. So it's not a stoic kind of packaged wisdom that we learn and then project out, but it's an intuitive, flowing, learning kind of mindfulness as it's deepened and developed in collaboration with other qualities that's constantly learning, picking up. What's an obstacle? What's a help? What's a support? Yeah. Where's resistance? Where's movement? Where's flow? Where's constriction? And it's learning, moving, changing, developing, growing. So at the end of the Raymond Carver story, I mentioned what we talk about when we talk about love. After their conversation ended, and they had kind of come at things from different angles and kind of went deeper. They're just sitting around the table in this room, and this is how it ends. One of the people, Terry, said, "Now what?" After this conversation had died out, "Now what?" I could hear my heart beating. I could hear everyone's heart. I could hear the human noise we sat there making, not one of us moving, even when the room went dark. So let's just sit for a moment together. So we'll let these words settle and fade. So, thank you all for your attention. So our attempt with just going to sound was to keep the shades open, which was my request that seems to have been complicating, so my apologies for that. But my experience of sitting here the last couple of weeks and being able to see out has been so extraordinary. That actually reminds me of, you know, practicing in Asia, often you're outside, really just exposed to the elements, but there isn't, you know, it really breaks down fast the illusion of, you know, me in my own separate cloister right here. It's like everything is coming in, you know, bugs, heat, dirt, sounds, smells. So there's something I think wondrous, and the Buddha recommended all the time, go find the root of a tree, go sit down under a tree, you know, remember your place with the nature. So to me, like, one of the benefits of this space is that suddenly we've got some backdrop of the natural world. So just inclines the mind differently. Anyway, love to hear your thoughts, reflections, questions, of your experiments with mindfulness, anything. Is this helpful? Confusing? Very open. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I was thinking of class I'm taking, we were talking about the cells in our body, each containing the entire the system we think we, cardiovascular.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. Great, great. Yeah, I think Tweri talked about it, it was last week, about it being kind of a hologram. So you go into each factor deeply, and I think all of the teachings are like this. You go deep enough into any one piece, and you'll actually find your way to all of the others. They're kind of all represented in there. So I think that's valid. But yeah. Yeah, Deb.
I was kind of chagrined when you were talking about the inappropriate question. that's constantly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
What's going on here? What's happening to me? What am I doing?
Yeah.
And to the extent that I can't even remember now what the appropriate kind of question is, I wonder if you could reframe them. Or
yeah. So could everyone... Here, no. So her question was feeling a lot of resonance with the inappropriate kind of attention. What was I in the past? What will I be in the future? Was I not? How am I? And being inwardly perplexed by the present, which I love. And she couldn't remember then what the appropriate kind of attention was. So that's the kind of wise or deep or fathoming attention. It's the kind of questioning that refers us back to what's happening in the present and how we're being affected by it. Right? Right? So here's the experience of heat. That's a certain sense input on my skin, sweat, and feeling. And it goes absolutely past the level of concepts. So the question refers directly back to experience itself. Mm-hmm. So.
But after you discern that, isn't there a natural inclination to put that into a framework, an analytical framework? Is that where you get off track again?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we can get off track anywhere, pretty much. But, right. So some concepts are helpful, right? Like a helpful understanding. And that's why naming it, mindfulness is present, energy is present, or energy is absent. Yeah? So that was a concept or label that the Buddha recommended as being a helpful frame of reference. A helpful framework. So rather than questioning, just knowing this is aversion, right? This is doubt. So a lot of the unhelpful questioning could also think of as doubt. Yeah. The creating the story of me, moment to moment. What am I? What am I not? Is that help?
Yeah, I have to sit with that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Daniel.
I found the simile of the hand, as the palm of the hand being the citta,
uh-huh.
and the fingers being wise attention.
Yeah. Right, right.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank Ajahn Suchito for that. Yeah. Yeah. But it's about the relationship, right? So it's about bringing in the information and feeling it. Yeah. Great. Mm. Yeah, Lord. How am I with this? Yeah. 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 Yes, and that can be really skillful, actually. That part can be skillful. So this comes back to the nuance again. So for those of you who couldn't hear, she was asking about Ajahn Suchito's question when he's talking about this kind of deep attention is how... All right, get ready. How am I with this? So... he also says something that's been very helpful for me, which is don't go into something until you can stay out of it. So this is a timing thing as well. So Tuari mentioned last week, mindfulness is a protector that guards the senses. So there's a time when it's very skillful just to stay at the sense doors at the level of sensation, you know? And we're not probing, because every time we start to kind of feel more deeply into, like investigate more deeply, we're caught downstream. So there's there's a place for just stabilizing, guarding, protecting the mind until there's enough strength and capacity and sensitivity to really go into it in a way that we can get understanding instead of being, you know, they're called floods for a reason, swept downstream by the flood. So there's where mindfulness can really be a protector until we have some strength, like a post or a pillar, you know. So it's so different, it's, you know, it can be so, fulfill such different functions and purposes. So thank you, that's really helpful. Others? Yeah. So Peter was saying, somewhat similar to Lauren, I think, this question of how am I with this? You know, we have to actually do that practice with that question to see if it's helpful. So how am I with this question? Where does it lead? Does it lead me to, you know, that's where it's always coming back to kind of our own creativity, experimentation, but that sensitivity. Every time I ask that question, I seem to be drawn into an analysis of my emotions, and that doesn't seem helpful. Maybe what's more helpful is an more impersonal question, like, what's present in the heart mind at this moment? Yeah, or Ajahn Sumedho's refrain was, agitation is like this. Anxiety is like this. Feeling confused, perplexed, it's like this. So it connected the recognition, the identification with some sense of a felt sense, which I think is what he's pointing to. It brought those two together, the felt sense, the fingers in the palm, the felt sense and the knowing of experience and the sensations. And, you know, in my own early practice, there's a lot of emphasis in the technique I was trained in, you know, just staying at the level of sensation for a long time. Right? And it was helpful. It felt incredibly grounding. And if we're really in deep connection with the sensations in the body as fluid, moving energies, not fighting against them, the mind is, or the conceptual mind, it's like a whisper compared to that, you know? It kind of dwarfs the proliferative mind. If we're really in touch with that, it's like fluid movement of sensations in the body. It does become like a protection or a post. So it gives us a lot of strength. Yeah. But if we've been tied to the post for years and we feel solid and steady, then maybe our edge is to start experimenting, right? It's to start venturing out. So the point is not to always stay tied to the post, but to really venture out and experiment. So in that moment that I'm feeling flooded or overwhelmed, you know, how do I experience anxiety as a flow of sensations in the body? You know, a recent one I worked with was dread. How do I experience dread as a flow of sensations in the body? It works, you know, it is. So the mind will have endless stories about where we should go, how we should fix it, why it got there, who am I? I am this dread-filled person, whatever. But at a sensation level, it's quite simple if we can allow it to move. Well, thanks everyone. Really nice to be with you again. And you know, the wonderful invitation, especially in this tradition, is to take what's useful, probably heard, and leave the rest. So don't proliferate around the rest, what you didn't get. Am I this? Am I that? Was it this? Was it that? Did she mean that? Did she mean this? What? Take an image, take a phrase, take a question, and make it part of your own inquiry, right? So the wisdom is your own fluid, moving, deepening, responsive wisdom. It's not an academic enterprise, right? Okay. So, thank you. Really enjoyed this. And I'll be around for a few more minutes if anyone has questions they'd like to ask. And are there specific instructions about taking Zabutons and Zafus downstairs? Do people know what to do now, Deb? Yeah. Follow somebody who looks like they know what they're doing, right? Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.